So today I'm going to be talking about state restoration during storage controller micro recovery. And this is joint work with Larry Chu from IBM Almaden Research Center and Ling Liu from Georgia Tech. Here's the outline for today's talk. First, I'm going to talk about storage system availability and some of the challenges that we face in achieving high availability in storage systems. Next, I'm going to talk about firmware availability. So I'm going to introduce firmware to you and talk about the issues that is faced in firmware recovery. And we're going to talk about how we can improve firmware availability through micro recovery. And I'll be presenting the log-lock architecture for state restoration during micro recovery. I'll briefly discuss evaluation, and then I'll conclude with some future directions and open up for questions. So as we all know here, storage systems are the foundations of today's data centers, and enterprises deal with extremely large amounts of data and rely heavily on storage systems to provide very, very high availability. Now, while the requirement for availability is increasing, there are new trends like consolidation and adapting newer multi-core architectures and virtualization that are creating new issues and new challenges. So firstly, we are dealing with complex legacy architectures, and these architectures are being adapted to new hardware, which means that very often it's not going to be feasible to rewrite all the existing systems. Next, if you look at the development and the quality assurance processes, these are often concurrent, which means that it is going to be very difficult to completely test the system and make sure that it's bug-free. That's not going to happen. And we look at the size of the installations. These installations typically have thousands of components. There are multiple applications running over shared resources, and all these applications have different expectations from the underlying platform. So in essence, this means that failures are going to be the norm in the system and not the exception. And it also means that in order to improve the availability of storage systems, we have to focus on the recovery time. But the challenge is that existing failure recovery mechanisms are insufficient to deal with the scale and the complexity of modern-day storage systems. So here we are very specifically dealing with storage controllers and the firmware inside storage controllers. So let me give you an idea of what storage controllers look like. So here's a system model. Storage controllers typically provide functionality such as RAID, I/O routing, and error recovery, mirroring, a lot of disaster recovery algorithms go inside the storage controller. And this controller is typically composed of a large number of interacting components. So you have a SCSI command processor, you might have a cache manager, a device manager, and all these components interact. And they dispatch, they perform work by dispatching a large number of asynchronous, very short-running tasks. Each task is of the order of 500 microseconds. And these tasks are enqueued onto a job queue. And then you have a processor complex containing multi-core processors and SMPs, which have many threads that are running concurrently. And these threads pick work from the job queue and execute them. Now, the system is susceptible to both permanent and transient failures. Of course, there's a lot of redundancy built into the system. There are redundant controllers. There is redundant network paths and things like that. But in spite of that, you also have a lot of transient failures in these systems. Now, transient failures typically result in service loss and are recovered when the system is restarted. They just disappear on restart. There are different types of transient failures. You have domain errors, range errors. You can refer to the paper for a detailed classification. But let me give you some examples of typical transient failures that happen in these systems. As I said, because it's a concurrent system, you have timeout conditions, you have race conditions and boundary conditions. There could be just insufficient error handling. And also because it is interacting with a lot of external devices and external components, you could have failures that arise from a third-party component not handling a particular packet properly or sending back a unrecognized error code or returning a failure, which the system doesn't know how to handle. And in essence, the system ends up in an unknown state. And then there are also failures because of configuration issues. So the administrator probably goes through a series of configuration changes to take the system to the state that it is in presently. And many of these changes are not undone correctly. So after some period of proper operation, the system finds itself in an unknown state, doesn't know how to recover, and then tries to restart. So typically the way that the system deals with transient failures today is by performing a system-wide recovery or system-wide restart. So there are many threads that are running in the system, and if a single thread encounters a failure, The current way to return the system to a known state is by aborting and restarting all threads. And in doing so, you have to check all your persistent in-memory data structures for consistency. And since you have lost your context, you have to wait for the host to redrive work. Now, what is the reason to do this? It's just because there's so much interaction and so many dependencies inside the system that it is very difficult to figure out how to perform, say, localized recovery inside the system. So with the current system size, say about 8 cores, you can limit the system recovery time to around 6 seconds. But the problem is, as a system will grow in size, which it definitely will, and as the size of your in-memory structures increase, then this entire recovery process is going to take much longer. And so it's going to become very difficult to stay within your availability targets, and as a result, also the recovery time will not scale linearly with the size of the system. So is there a way by which we can perform scalable failure recovery in these storage microcontrollers? Now, the things that we must consider when we design a scalable failure recovery mechanism is that, first, we are dealing with a legacy architecture. This is around 2 million lines of code, which means that it is not acceptable to redesign the entire system. Next, we have to take care of dynamic dependencies because many of these dependencies will manifest at runtime. And the recovery semantics are also more complex because we are talking about software recovery as against transaction recovery in databases. And also, at the same time, in spite of doing all this, you must still sustain high performance. So the requirement is for a retrofittable mechanism that's dynamic and is low overhead. So here is a comparison between system-level recovery and task-level recovery. So system-level recovery is the mechanism that is currently being used by the system. So on error detection, you stop all system operation, you lock the system state, and then you restart the entire system and resume operation. Now, what we are proposing is to perform task-level recovery, which is much more scalable. So here, when you detect an error, you halt only the operation of the faulty task, you log the task state, and then you perform task-level recovery. And the recovery strategy might vary. For example, if it is an error that you could ignore, then you just continue. If it is an error that cannot be handled at this level, then you probably have to propagate the error to the next higher level and probably have to fall back on system-level recovery. Or you could try to retry and roll back and retry in some of the cases. But when we perform task-level recovery, we must make sure that we take care of all the dependent tasks and all the dependencies in the system. So we have developed a framework, which is a recovery-conscious framework, for performing fine-grained task-level recovery in the storage controller. So I'm going to present an overview of the framework, but today's talk and this paper focuses only on stage one of the framework. So what the framework does is that it breaks the task of retrofitting fine-grained recovery into your storage controller into multiple stages. So in the first stage, it tries to identify the scope of a recovery, and then it tries to identify the right strategy to take the system to a consistent state. Once these recovery scopes, that is the set of tasks that need to recover together, have been identified in stage one, at stage two, we take the system configuration, you know, the size of the system, your availability requirements, your performance requirements into consideration, and try to realign the recovery scopes into what is known as recovery group, so that you can, you know, balance the trade-off between the overhead for fine-grained recovery tracking and the performance. At the third stage, these recovery groups are allocated resources using recovery-conscious scheduling. The goal of recovery-conscious scheduling is to serialize some dependent tasks so that you have better control on the number of dependent tasks that execute at any time, so that you can limit the amount of resources and time that you need to perform recovery. So in today's talk, we're going to focus on stage one, that is fine-grained recovery. So here the questions that we are trying to answer are, what is a good recovery strategy? When do you know that fine-grained recovery is going to be successful? And how do we restore the system to an error-free state? And to answer these questions, we have developed the log-lock state restoration architecture. So first we need to understand what are the dependencies between concurrent threads in this system. So threads interact in some very fundamental ways. So you have state dependencies and you have resource dependencies. So state dependencies usually manifest through, you know, shared data structures, and you have read-write dependencies on that state. Otherwise, there could be shared resources which are acquired from a common pool, and these are the kinds of resource dependencies that are there in the system. And finally, you have interactions with outside world processes. So a system may respond to a user request, it may position a disk head, or it may just respond to an I/O or do an action that has been committed to the outside world and cannot be rolled back. Now, the recovery mechanism that we have should capture all these dependencies and account for these dependencies. But the kinds of recovery actions that are required and the kinds of dependencies that are actually interesting to recovery depend on the context. So I'm going to go over a couple of examples that talk about how in different contexts you have different recovery actions and you have different dependencies that are interesting. So here's a simple example of a task which is trying to write something to cache. So you start a SCSI command, you process a read, and then you try to get a cache track. And say in this process, this task acquires some temporary resource from a shared pool. And after some duration of processing, it encounters an exception and fails and has to recover. Now in this situation, when we are performing the recovery, say we are just rolling back and retrying the task, or we are ignoring this task drop, maybe this is a background task that is not critical and so we can drop it. But whatever be the recovery strategy that we choose, we should make sure that any resource that was acquired from a shared pool is relinquished correctly. But in this case, we don't care about reads or write to the resource because the resource goes back into the shared pool, so we don't care about reads and writes. And now here's another example where you have a shared variable called the metadata location, which is updated. So before this task updates the metadata location, it locks the metadata location, updates it. This is probably the location of a checkpoint disk. And then it unlocks the resource and continues operating. But after some time, suppose it finds that the location was faulty and is going to cause the system to fail, then the task has an option. Now it can roll back and retry and try to change the metadata location. But in doing so, it has to make sure that nobody has already consumed this faulty location and has already started writing to it. So in this case, we care about dirty reads to the state variable. So if a dirty read has already occurred, then the thread probably cannot just roll back and retry and probably has to resort to system level recovery. Likewise, if you take a counter which is just generating unique sequence numbers, then after a failure has occurred, you probably don't have to bother resetting the counter. But if it's some other counter that is critical and has to have the right value, then you have to make sure that you undo your changes if you have done them. So what we're trying to say here is that different contexts will have different requirements for recovery actions and different requirements for state that needs to be tracked. And so threads may or may not care about resource dependencies, dirty reads, unrepeatable reads, say lost updates, or externally visible actions. It depends upon what the thread is trying to do. So if you take databases, then you have to have strict ACID guarantees, and all these dependencies are enforced strictly for all transactions that execute in a database system. You probably perform two-phase locking and take all the locks in the beginning of the transaction and release them at the end of the transaction and make sure that there are no dependencies between other transactions so that you can roll back or abort your changes. So the difference here is that we have some flexibility. And also here, performance is very important and concurrency is very critical. So again, we need a flexible and lightweight recovery strategy. So that is what log-lock is. And the intuition here is that your shared state and resources are going to be protected by a lock or some other primitive like that. So if you keep tracking your lock and unlock calls, then you have some idea of how your state is changing. And if you have a framework that tracks that for you, then somehow the framework can guide the way resources are being owned, the way the resources are and state is being written and consumed by concurrent threads in the system. Now, the advantage is that with this kind of a mechanism, you can take an incremental approach and track only entities that are interesting to a particular recovery action. So before I give you an overview of the system architecture, let me first introduce some terms. So we have a recoverable thread. That is a thread which supports micro-recovery. And a thread which supports micro-recovery introduces sets a recovery context. That is, it sets a recovery point, which is basically a starting point from where you can resume recovery after a failure has occurred. And each recovery point is associated with a recovery criterion, which is a set of conditions that must be satisfied by the system at the time of failure in order to use the recovery point. Next, we have something called a restoration level, which basically describes the failure context. So it captures the context at the time of failure in the system. So as I said, the recovery point and the recovery criterion capture the recovery context, and the restoration level captures the failure context. So here's an overview of the system architecture. There are two components here. One is the log-lock execution model, and the other is the restoration protocols. So the log-lock execution model has the recovery point and the recovery criterion, which is the recovery context, and then it has the failure context in terms of the restoration level, and it also has a module that tracks state dependencies and resource dependencies. So assume that there are multiple concurrent threads in the system, and so the thread with the solid line is a thread that is recoverable. So what a recoverable thread needs to do in this situation is that it first sets a recovery point, saying that if a failure happens, this is the place from where I would like to start recovery. And then it also indicates to the log-lock execution model state and resource that it is interested in tracking. So it says these are the state instances that I'm modifying, and I'm interested in tracking these state instances. And this is the resource that I would be acquiring, and I'm interested in tracking ownership information about this resource. So once the threads continue to execute, then the system automatically starts logging the state changes and the resource changes. Then when a failure happens, then control is transferred to something known as a recovery handler. Now this recovery handler is a recovery routine that is provided by the developer. Now it performs state restoration and recovery actions. So in order to perform state restoration, what happens is that first, based on the state dependency and resource dependency information that is logged by the system, we compute the restoration level, that is, we compute the failure context. And then the failure context and the recovery context is fed into the recovery handler. Now the developer can interpret the recovery context and the failure context in whichever manner he finds suitable. And then he can consult the restoration protocols and use the restoration protocols to decide what are the set of things that he needs to do to take the system back to a consistent state. So what are the state restoration actions that he needs to do, and what are the recovery actions that he needs to perform? So let's look at what the restoration protocols look like. So assume that there are two threads in the system. There's T1 and T2. And let's assume that T1 is the thread that encounters a failure. Now a thread can perform write actions, read actions. It can unlock a resource or a state. Fail, it can end, it can acquire a resource, and it can release a resource. Now the events that are interesting from the standpoint of state restoration are dirty reads, where the fail thread has already written some data which has been read by another thread, after which T1 fails. Or there could be lost updates, where T1 has written some information, T2 has overwritten the information, and now T1 fails. Now if T1 were to go back and rewrite the original value, then it must take into consideration that it will be overwriting the changes of T2. There could be unrepeatable reads where T1 performs a read and T2 performs a write. And now if T1 fails, then if it goes back and reads, then the value has probably changed. Likewise, you can have a situation that represents residual resources where a resource or a lock has been acquired but not released. And finally, there are committed dependencies where a thread has a dependency on another thread. Say T1 has a dependency on T2, but T2 has already committed, which means that T1 has no way to roll back without notifying T2, but T2 has already committed, so it cannot roll back. So there are some recovery strategies that are available to a thread. So it could either perform a single thread rollback, or if multiple threads on which it is dependent are active at that point, then it could perform multi-thread rollback, or it could perform error compensation or roll forward, or if it thinks that the failure cannot be handled, then it just performs a system restart. Now, as I said, the restoration level, which captures the failure context, will capture the occurrence of the five events, that is dirty reads, lost updates, unrepeatable reads, residual resources, and committed dependencies. So the restoration level will capture the occurrence of these five events at the time of failure. And the recovery point and the recovery criterion that have been set by the recoverable thread will capture the set of events that can be handled by a particular thread. So what the restoration protocols essentially mean are that if there's a resource dependency, then the if there's a mismatch between the residual resources criterion that is specified by the recovery context and the failure context, then the thread must make sure that it acquires or releases the resources correctly in order to start using the recovery point. And then as for state dependencies, if the recovery criterion, that is the failure context, exactly matches the recovery context, then a single thread can perform recovery. But if it does not match, then multiple threads have to be involved. Now, if multiple threads are going to be involved in the recovery, then recovery is possible only if none of the threads have already committed. So in interest of time, I'm going to move a little bit faster. So next we come to the log-lock execution model. So with log-lock, there are two logs that are maintained in the system. So there is an undo log, which is a local log per recoverable thread. And this log is maintained by the developer. So he can use the undo log to write any information that he wants to save and he wants to use at the time of recovery into an undo log. And then there's the change track log, which is maintained globally. So the change track log is maintained one per lock. And all threads that are using the log, or locking and reading or writing that particular instance of state, their interactions are logged in the change track log. And also commit and unlock and lock actions are also logged. And we provide like four primitives to the developer. So it's start tracking, stop tracking. And these two are used during, these two are introduced into the recoverable thread and are used during normal path operation to start tracking changes. And then during recovery, we have two primitives that are used. One is get restoration level, which returns the failure context, and the other is get resource ownership, which returns ownership information. So here's an example of how these would be used in the system. So this is the example for the metadata location, a state that was changing. So thread T1, if it is recoverable and interested in tracking recovery information, would start tracking the mdata location lock. And after it has finished all its changes, it will probably stop tracking. Now, once it has started tracking a particular information, then a change track log is created for that particular instance. And thread 2, which now reads from the metadata location variable, and the thread 2's actions are logged onto the change track log, which is a global log. I would encourage you to look at the paper for more examples of how the logs are actually used. I'm going to move ahead to the evaluation. So we have implemented log-lock on an enterprise storage controller with a simulated backend. And the evaluation was aimed at evaluating the effectiveness and the efficiency of log-lock. So the key results are that the performance overhead was acceptable. It was lesser than 10% impact, even while tracking state that was changing at the rate of 15,000 times per second. And for the particular storage controller code that we implemented the log-lock architecture into, and for the particular instance of code that we evaluated, there was an extremely high rate of recovery success. So recovery success is the percentage of time that your failure context actually matches your recovery context, allowing you to perform fine-grained recovery. And so for the way that this code was written, because it was originally developed to be highly concurrent, we found that there was nearly 99% recovery success, meaning 99% of the time you could actually use fine-grained recovery for certain threads. And as for the recovery time, there was a significant improvement in recovery time. So we reduced the downtime. So without micro recovery, you have about 4 seconds of downtime, and then an additional 2 seconds to regain original performance. But with micro recovery, this reduces to a 35% throughput drop for about 6 seconds. So I'm skipping the experimental setup. And so here are the results for the rate. So this is basically looking at the rate at which state is changing and the rate at which we are tracking the state changes and what is the impact of that on the throughput of the system. So as you can see, there's lesser than 10% of impact on the performance. There are more results in the paper for latency and for other workloads. And I'm moving ahead to the result on recovery time. So we injected failures. So we chose tasks that could be recovered using fine-grained recovery. Of course, not all tasks are recoverable through fine-grained recovery. And so for one particular task that we chose, we injected failures into the system, and we evaluated the recovery time that was required to bring back the system to normal operation. So with only system-level recovery, this resulted in about 4% downtime. But whereas with the log-lock architecture, as I said, this reduced the impact of a failure to a 35% drop in throughput because only the thread that was failing was undergoing recovery. So there's work on checkpointing and logging, and checkpointing and logging are probably applicable to systems for long-running tasks. But as I said, here we have short-running tasks, which reduces the applicability of those techniques. And then, of course, there are techniques that can be applied at higher levels, like reboots and micro-reboots and periodic rejuvenations using environmental diversity. So all those techniques are complementary to what we're using. So what we are trying to do is try to have localized recovery in addition to system-level recovery. So in conclusion, today we saw how storage systems are becoming much more complex, and the availability expectations are increasing, and how system-wide recovery does not scale in these systems. So our contribution is a framework for fine-grained recovery and the log-lock architecture, which allows dependencies to be tracked and which allows fine-grained recovery to actually be implemented in the system. So in future, we plan to look at trying to reduce the need for programmer intervention and also try to evaluate the architecture with other highly concurrent systems. I'm out of time. Thank you. So I can take questions. Yes, thank you.
Hi, Rick Spillane from Swedenborg University. I just wanted to ask, so you said earlier in your talk that if you got a dirty read, then that would probably lead to having to perform system recovery, is that correct?
Yeah.
So did you look at how often processes were performing dirty reads? Because I know that for instance, at least in the kernel context, you've got lots of threads that share common data structures. They're just going to go in there, dump data, and go away and leave, and maybe crash later. So how interdependent are these different threads of context? And
I think that that's a good observation, because there are a lot of systems where there are a lot of dirty reads, which essentially mean that you won't probably be able to recover using fine-grained recovery. But not all failures are recoverable through micro recovery. So if there's a dirty read, it is not recoverable through micro recovery. Now, for the failures that we thought that could be handled using micro recovery in the storage controller, there was a high percentage of times when there was no dirty read in the system. So as you can see from here, we are tracking the I/O state. You can refer to the paper too. So I/O state is an instance of state that changes very frequently. And in this case, the recovery success was about 99.38%, which means that most of the time there were no dirty reads in the system. And the reason is the tasks by themselves are very short running, so it's just around 500 microseconds. And that itself limits the window that is open for dirty reads. It also means that our recovery context is limited to a single task. So if we start looking at larger recovery contexts, maybe sequence of tasks, then we would see more dirty reads in the system.
So do you think your performance would stay low tasks that take longer to run and would have to hold those locks longer, do you think that you would start impacting your concurrent performance in that scenario if you were to apply this technique to tasks that run longer than 5 microseconds?
This technique does not force the tasks to hold their locks for longer. So it just tracks the way that the locks are acquired and deleted. But of course, if the duration of a task increases, that means that the length of the log is also going to increase. So we have conducted experiments about how the performance is affected by the duration of a task, and those experiments are there in the paper. I can discuss them offline.
Okay, thank you.